Oh my goodness, Redick! Welcome to Sound It Out. Hi, this is Rachel Elliott. Welcome to Sound It Out. On this show, we talk about social formations and how they play out in musical situations. This is the second half of our second episode ever. And so the theme for this show continues to be the conference that took place in Montreal in the middle of June called Improvisation and the Politics of Everyday Sounds, Cornelius Cordue and Beyond. This episode features more of the chat that I had with Iacario Rodriguez, one of the organizers of the colloquium. I also speak with Gassia Uzunian from the Sonic Arts Research Center at Queen's University, Belfast. But most of the episode is really taken up with this absolutely sublime musical performance, spontaneously performed by strangers to each other with varying degrees of musical ability or training. So once that part of the show starts kicking in, I would find a really comfortable location to just sit down, or even better, lie down, turn off the lights, maybe put a candle on, and just bliss out. Also on the show are selections from Marcel Swoboda's talk called Thinking and Acting Collectively Along the Lines of Cornelius Cordue. And I am going to insist on a very short reading from Ludwig Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. This show is, of course, broadcasting out of CFRU, University of Guelph's campus radio station, and is produced in conjunction with IC, International Institute for Critical Studies in Improvisation. I'm Rachel Elliott. Enjoy the show. What's up? What's up?
What's up?
I think Cordue's a really relevant figure for people today, and I think if he were better known, there would be a lot of interest. Yeah. Reading that's undertaken from a place of great affection for Cornelius Cordue, and precisely because it's a place of great affection, great love for him, it's also a place where one can articulate a very, very strong criticism.
This is postdoctoral researcher at McGill University in association with IC, Iacario Rodriguez.
Cordue was wonderful, let's just all celebrate, you know, in a very homogeneous fashion what he did. Because I think when one starts to really investigate these experiences, this idea of coming together to collectively perform with non-trained performers, experimenting with scores that are not traditional scores, so conventional forms of notation. These are things that have very interesting entailments. And when I say interesting, it can be both positive and negative. I mean, I think many of the papers in the conference dealt with that. I remember, for example, Adam Tinkle's paper on novicehood. And the idea of bringing in non-trained performers or performers who have absolutely no musical training to these kinds of musical ensembles or experiences or experiments. And he problematized that in a way that I thought was really very productive, because, you know, it this idea of the novice or the untrained performer, you know, that figure can be used as a resource, as an other that is lacking in something and therefore brings something new. So this idea of novelty. So there's kind of this idea of novelty that comes with, you know, paradigmatic ideas of modernity brought back into the discourse. And if we don't problematize that, then, you know, that novice becomes another figure of the other, right? And yet, that opening up of a space for people without traditional musical training into the world of music as a social formation, as an institution, and as a particular discourse on sound, as a particular framing of sound, also was interesting. I mean, I think it had to do with an epochal ethos of allowing different voices to be heard, of opening up one's ears to different, to listen to different discourses and voices. And so, you know, it has both sides to it.
I'm not going to play a recording that I made of the participants in the Cardew Colloquium singing paragraph 7 of Cornelius Cardew's work called The Great Learning. So this is sort of, I guess, an example of the novice. This piece is designed for people who don't necessarily know how to read a score or interpret regular music notation. So the score or the singing instructions look like a list of words, and the words have a number beside them, and you sing each word that number of times on a note of your choosing for a duration of one breath. I'm going to actually let Gasia Uzunia explain the instructions, but first I'll just say that the lyrics of this work come from a Confucius poem, and they are, "If the root be in confusion, nothing will be well governed. The solid cannot be swept away as trivial, nor can trash be established as solid. It just does not happen."
Across the entire building, and you'll see how that we got the score now, and maybe it'll be a good idea. We'll only do the notation first. So then where it says notation. Okay, so now how does the notation work? It's very simple. There's only really two instructions. The first instruction is the word sing. If you see the word sing 9F2 swept away, what that means is sing the words swept away on the length of a breath note with the syllables freely disposed 9 times, the same note each time. Of the 9 notes, any two should be loud, the rest soft. Each chorus member chooses his or her own note silently for the first line, which is this 8 times. So that means that you're thinking of that note. Everyone starts on their own note. For each subsequent line, choose a note that you can hear being sung by a colleague. It may be necessary to move within earshot at certain notes. So, the first line, you pick your note. For every subsequent line, you have to pick a note that somebody else is singing. In order to pick that note, you might have to move to where they are, so you can hear what note they're singing. It says that a note, once chosen, must be carefully retained. Sounds easy, hard to do. Because you're going to hear lots of pitches around you changing, and it's easy to kind of like shift up or like shift down to kind of make what ends up being sometimes tonic chords, like major and minor chords. Anyhow, let's move on, but that's the instruction. So sing the same note as many number of times. So again, once you choose that next note for the next line, you hold that for every time you sing that line. And it says time may be taken over the choice. And I would say, you know, when you're maybe moving to find your next note, take as much time as you want. And the other directional is move gently. A, it's quite a few people are in here, but it's also because people are going to be really trying to listen. So just move gently and allow for people to continue listening. And take as much time as you want to get to your next line. If there is no note, or only the note you have just been singing, or only a note or notes that you are unable to sing, do not sing the same note on two consecutive lines. So you're always changing every time you go to the next line. Okay, each singer progresses through the text at his or her own speed, remains stationary for the duration of the line, so when you're singing one line, you don't move, and then move around only between lines. So the way we'll do it is we're going to start kind of in the foyer of the building, and when you're going to get your next line, feel free to move somewhere else. And in a sense, the piece is going to evolve across the entire space. We'll see how it works.
Hi. I'm still here. I hope you are too. We're going to do a little snorkeling around in archive sort of material and take a listen to Marcel Swoboda's talk entitled Thinking and Acting Collectively Along the Lines of Cornelius Cardew. I absolutely love this talk, which is about the influence of the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein on Cornelius Cardew as well, although to a lesser extent in terms of what I'm presenting you with here, the 17th century philosopher Baruch Spinoza.
Period is marked by philosophical interests. He was used as sounding boards for his musical practice, provided a way of understanding not just what makes these experiments musically singular, but how their singularity testifies to ethical concerns. Most well documented among the preoccupations of Cardew is his abiding interest in the work of the Austrian-British philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, a thinker whose formal rigour strongly resonated with Cardew's compositional training, and whose attempts to propound an ethical conception of being were of no less importance for the composer. A particular value for Cardew was Wittgenstein's landmark early work, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus from 1922, whose radical attempt to distill the fundamental logical basis by means of which philosophical meaning is produced proved a significant influence on Cardew's experimental music of the period, in particular his work Treatise. No less crucially, Wittgenstein's attempts to exhaust a logical philosophical possibility as a means to affirming the mystical silence, as he called it, of being that remains when all philosophical questioning has been laid to rest, also proved influential on Cardew and points to both a shared preoccupation with the formal distillation of first principles and a strong ethical affinity. This going beyond or below theory appealed to Cornelius Cardew with respect to his own endeavours during the 1960s and early 1970s, as he wrote in his essay Towards an Ethic of Improvisation, quote, from 1971, Wittgenstein abandoned theory and all the glory that theory can bring on a philosopher in favour of an illustrative technique, my emphasis. While for Cardew this pertained mainly to Wittgenstein's late work, namely the Philosophical Investigations, one can also find evidence in the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. Consider as a case in point here, the score for Treatise. Heavily inspired by the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, this score was produced between 1963 and 67. An attempt to picture sound as Wittgenstein sought to picture meaning. This remarkable 193-page document employs a panoply of graphic techniques whose fidelity to the strictures of conventional annotation are minimal. While these minimal affordances remain crucial to the score in their sparingness. In this score, Cardew dismantles and reassembles the orthography of notation, emphasising the material character of line, shape and volume, all key to the functioning of this orthography, but barely recognisable in its terms, and at times bearing more resemblance to engineering diagrams than to musical notation. Like Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and I would contend Spinoza's Ethics, the Treatise score is intended in some ways to picture the world as it is. If we think of it in terms of immanence, it seemingly constitutes an attempt to distill the fundamental basis on which all forms of documentary orthography are based, not just musical annotation, but written inscription more broadly, foregrounding in the process the potential gestures and ideational associations by which musical meaning in this case is pictured to such an extent that the score becomes a document of these very gestures and ideations themselves, rather than any kind of commentary on them. Hence, by eschewing transcendent authority or the traditional hierarchies established by means of correct orthographic inscription, Cardew's treatise, like Wittgenstein and Spinoza in their respective treatises, seeks to go beyond or below theory, in this case theories on or of improvisation, to an imminent practical and ethical basis for expressive interaction. In Spinoza's terms, the symbols comprising the score, shorn of linguistic and semantic codes, become stand-ins for and expressions of bodily modifications. So to come on to another case in point, I think a more concrete illustration of what I'm trying to articulate here is the score for The Tiger's Mind. In text-based, The Tiger's Mind issues all purely visual, graphic and diagrammatic inscription, opting instead for what amounts to a series of short elliptical prose statements, serving as a kind of dramaturgy dividing between two overarching sections, day piece and night piece. Both pieces to be formed by six characters, through which the music is improvisationally staged. The characters are Tiger, Amy, Tree, Circle, Wind and Mind. I want to finish all too briefly and sadly with a few remarks regarding the Great Learning. The Great Learning was the last large-scale experimental The Last of the Great Large-Scale Experimental School, produced by Carnegie during the late 60s and early 70s. John Tilbury described The Great Learning as a philosophical text conceived to, quote, create good, not in an easy way. Written to be performed by the then recently established Scratch Orchestra, which Carnegie was a founding member, The Great Learning, while being wholly singular in its own right, displays many of the philosophical preoccupations evidenced in the earlier scores, in particular with regard to ethics, which is a major driving force in its work, explicitly so. Based on Ezra Pound's translation of Confucius's classic, The Great Learning, the work uses all the different elements to be found in the earlier scores, notably graphic and topographic inscriptions, as well as text and use of characters. Sorry, it's a bit small on the display here. But also introduces other elements, notably scoring for material objects. Certainly, the fact that the work was conceived to be played collectively by trained musicians and enthusiastic amateurs find the synthesizing aspects of both treatise and the timeless mind, while surpassing them in scope, scale, and complexity. The doubtless the many things Carnegie was presumably wishing to achieve here, he seems to have been seeking a technique for documenting music in a way that would be legible to trained and untrained musicians, such that their respective levels of musical competence could enter into productive dialogue. Carnegie's score for The Great Learning variously mobilizes a method of documentary inscription that explores the relative capacities of the professional amateur musicians, not least in terms of what their bodies can do, when it's, for example, the level of discipline required to maintain complex polyrhythmic interplays with the drumming characters in paragraph 2 of The Great Learning, alongside the ways in which the text from paragraph 7 makes certain breathing requirements or demands on the part of the untrained performers within the school. In concluding, it is hereby my contention that whatever ultimately characterises the singular trajectory of these scores, Carnegie's advocacy of illustrative technique during the mid-1960s and 1970s, for me, amounts to a cultivation and affirmation not just of musical thinking and acting, but of ethical thinking and acting, at once along musical and
time out for text.
So on the show, we do a little bit of a reading from a text that's usually a philosophy text and usually about music. This week is from the philosopher, Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, partly because I'm reading it at the moment and partly because it was figures prominently in Marcel Svoboda's talk on Cornelius Cardew. So Wittgenstein wrote the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus actually sort of in the trenches during World War I. He was in the Austrian army. Wittgenstein, despite being a logician, was a good model for practice-based research. He really wanted to get into life and put himself in all sorts of situations that would be fruitful for thinking about philosophy, or to which philosophy could fruitfully contribute. He was also a gardener and an elementary school teacher. Apparently, Ray Monk has written a really good sort of intellectual biography of Wittgenstein. In the preface to the Tractatus, Wittgenstein says his motivation is to deal with some of the problems of philosophy by showing that they rest on a misunderstanding of the logic of language, which he says can be summed up in the following quotation. What can be said at all can be said clearly, and wherefore one cannot speak, therefore one must remain silent. And I think this has sort of come down as a distinction between what can be shown versus what can be said. So this business of showing takes on this special importance with respect to a certain silence, a certain location that language can't approach. And so maybe pictures or graphics have a role in that domain.
Man possesses the ability to construct languages capable of expressing every sense, without having any idea how each word has meaning or what its meaning is, just as people speak without knowing how the individual sounds are produced. Everyday language is a part of the human organism and is no less complicated than it. It's not humanly possible to gather immediately from it what the logic of language is. Language disguises thought, so much so that from the outward form of the clothing it is impossible to infer the form of the thought beneath it, because the outward form of the clothing is not designed to reveal the form of the body, but for entirely different purposes. The tacit conventions on which the understanding of everyday language depends are enormously complicated. Most of the propositions and questions to be found in philosophical works are not false, but nonsensical. Consequently, we cannot give any answer to questions of this kind, but can only point out that they are nonsensical. Most of the propositions and questions of philosophers arise from our failure to understand the logic of our language. They belong to the same class as the question whether the good is more or less identical than the beautiful. And it is not surprising that the deepest problems are in fact not problems at all. All philosophy is a critique of language, though not in Mauthner's sense. It was Russell who performed the service of showing that the apparent logical form of a proposition need not be its real one. A proposition is a picture of reality. A proposition is a model of reality as we imagine it. At first sight, a proposition, one set out on the printed page, for example, does not seem to be a picture of the reality with which it is concerned. But neither do written notes seem at first sight to be a picture of a piece of music, nor our phonetic notation, the alphabet, to be a picture of our speech. Yet these sign languages prove to be pictures, even in the ordinary sense, of what they represent. It is obvious that a proposition of the form ARB strikes us as a picture. In this case, the sign is obviously a likeness of what is signified. And if we penetrate to the essence of this pictorial character, we see that it is not impaired by apparent irregularities, such as the use of sharp and flats in musical notation. For even these irregularities depict what they are intended to express, only they do it in a different way. A gramophone record, the musical idea, the written notes, and the sound waves all stand to one another in the same internal relation of depicting that holds between language and the world. They are all constructed according to a common logical pattern. Like the two ewes in the fairy tale, their two horses and their lilies, they are all, in a certain sense, one. There is a general rule by means of which the musician can obtain the symphony from the score, and which makes it possible to derive the symphony from the groove on the gramophone record, and, using the first rule, to derive the score again. That is what constitutes the inner similarity between these things, which seem to be constructed in such entirely different ways. And that rule is the law of projection, which projects the symphony into the language of musical notation. It is the rule for translating this language into the language of gramophone records. The possibility of all imagery, of all our pictorial modes of expression, is contained in the logic of depiction. In order to understand the essential nature of a proposition, we should consider hieroglyphic script, which depicts the facts that it describes, and alphabetic script developed out of it without losing what was essential to depiction. We can see this from the fact that we understand the sense of a propositional sign without its having been explained to us. A proposition is a picture of reality, for if I understand a proposition, I know the situation that it represents, and I understand the proposition without having had its sense explained to me. A proposition shows its sense. A proposition shows how things stand if it is true, and it says that they do so stand. A proposition must restrict reality to two alternatives, yes or no.
Thank you.
The people singing this piece of music were walking around the Sala Rosa in Montreal, so that's multiple stories in and out of different rooms. And the recording device that I made this on was being passed around, so it moved from place to place, from singer to singer. I love this part at the end, when there are so few voices left singing that you can hear the dishes being put away in the kitchen. That brings us to the end of our second episode of Sound It Out. The show is produced and hosted by myself, Rachel Elliott. It's out of CFRU campus radio station at the University of Guelph, and is partnered with the International Institute of Critical Studies and Improvisation. Check out improvcommunity.ca. I'm Rachel Elliott. See ya.